Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka with another episode from Sri Aurobindo's Synthesis of Yoga. Chapter 2, The Three Steps of Nature. We recognize then, in the past developments of yoga, a specializing and separative tendency which, like all things in nature, had its justifying and even imperative utility, and we seek a synthesis of the specialized aims and methods which have, in consequence, come into being. But in order that we may be wisely guided in our effort, we must know first the general principle and purpose underlying this separative impulse, and next, the particular utilities upon which the method of each school of yoga is founded. For the general principle, we must interrogate the universal workings of nature herself, recognizing in her no merely specious and elusive activity of a distorting maya, but the cosmic energy and working of God Himself in His universal being, formulated and inspired by a vast and infinite and yet a minutely selective wisdom. Wisdom that went forth from the eternal since the beginning. For the particular utilities, we must cast a penetrative eye on the different methods of yoga and distinguish among the mass of their details the governing idea which they serve and the radical force which gives birth and energy to their processes of effectuation. Afterwards, we may more easily find the one common principle and the one common power from which all derive their being and tendency, towards which all subconsciously move, and in which, therefore, it is possible for all consciously to unite. The progressive self-manifestation of nature and man, termed in modern language his evolution, must necessarily depend upon three successive elements. There is that which is already evolved. There is that which, still imperfect, still partly fluid, is persistently in the stage of conscious evolution. And there is that which is to be evolved and may perhaps be already displayed. If not constantly, then occasionally, or with some regularity of recurrence, in primary formations or in others more developed, and it well may be, even in some, however rare, that are near to the highest possible realization of our present humanity. For the march of nature is not drilled to a regular and mechanical forward stepping. She reaches constantly beyond herself, even at the cost of subsequent deplorable retreats. She has rushes, she has splendid and mighty outbursts, she has immense realizations. She storms sometimes passionately forward, hoping to take the kingdom of heaven by violence. And these self-exceedings are the revelation of that in her, which is most divine or else most diabolical, but in either case the most puissant to bring her rapidly forward towards her goal. That which nature has evolved for us and has firmly founded is the bodily life. She has effected a certain combination and harmony of the two inferior but most fundamentally necessary elements of our action and progress upon earth, matter, which, however the two etherically spiritual may despise, is our foundation and the first condition of all our energies and realizations. And the life energy, which is our means of existence in a material body, and the basis there even of our mental and spiritual activities. Nature has successfully achieved a certain stability of her constant material movement, which is at once sufficiently steady and durable and sufficiently pliable and mutable to provide a fit dwelling place and instrument for the progressively manifesting God in humanity. This is what is meant by the fable in the Aitareya Upanishad, which tells us that the gods rejected the animal forms successively offered to them by the divine self, and only when man was produced cried out, "Ah, this indeed is perfectly made," and consented to enter in. She has effected also a working compromise between the inertia of matter and the active life that lives in and feeds on it, by which not only is vital existence sustained, but the fullest developments of mentality are rendered possible. This equilibrium constitutes the basic status of nature in man and is termed, in the language of yoga, his gross body, composed of the material or food sheath and the nervous system vehicle. If then this inferior equilibrium is the basis and first means of the higher movements, which the universal power contemplates, and if it constitutes the vehicle in which the divine here seeks to reveal itself, if the Indian saying is true, that the body is the instrument provided for the fulfillment of the right law of our nature, then any final recoil from the physical life must be a turning away from the completeness of the divine wisdom and a renunciation of its aim in earthly manifestation. Such a refusal may be, owing to some secret law of their development, the right attitude for certain individuals, but never the aim intended for mankind. It can be, therefore, no integral yoga which ignores the body or makes its annulment or its rejection indispensable for perfect spirituality. Rather, the perfecting of the body also should be the last triumph of the spirit, and to make the bodily life also divine must be God's final seal upon his work in the universe. The obstacle which the physical presents to the spiritual is no argument for the rejection of the physical. For in the unseen providence of things, our greatest difficulties are our best opportunities. A supreme difficulty is nature's indication to us of a supreme conquest to be won, and an ultimate problem to be solved. It is not a warning of an inextricable snare to be shunned, or of an enemy too strong for us from whom we must flee. Equally, the vital and nervous energies in us are there for a great utility. They too demand the divine realization of their possibilities in our ultimate fulfillment. The great part assigned to this element in the universal scheme is powerfully emphasized by the Catholic wisdom of the Upanishads. As the spokes of a wheel in its nave, so in the life energy is all established. The triple knowledge and the sacrifice and the power of the strong and the purity of the wise. Under control of the life energy is all this that is established in the triple heaven. It is, therefore, no integral yoga that kills these vital energies, forces them into a nerveless quiescence, or roots them out as the source of noxious activities. Their purification, not their destruction, their transformation, control, and utilization is the aim in view with which they have been created and developed in us. If the bodily life is what nature has firmly evolved for us as her base and her first instrument, it is our mental life that she is evolving as her immediate next aim and superior instrument. This, in her ordinary exaltations, is the lofty preoccupying thought in her. This, except in her periods of exhaustion and recoil into a reposeful and recuperating obscurity, is her constant pursuit wherever she can get free from the trammels of her first vital and physical realization. For here in man, we have a distinction which is of the utmost importance. He has in him not a single mentality, but a double and a triple. The mind, material and nervous, the pure intellectual mind, which liberates itself from the illusions of the body and the senses, and a divine mind above intellect, which in its turn liberates itself from the imperfect modes of the logically discriminative and imaginative reason. Mind in man is first enmeshed in the life of the body, where in the plant it is entirely involved and in animals always imprisoned. It accepts this life as not only the first but the whole condition of its activities, and serves its needs as if they were the entire aim of existence. But the bodily life in man is a base, not the aim, his first condition and not his last determinant. In the just idea of the ancients, man is essentially the thinker, the manu, the mental being who leads the life and the body, not the animal who is led by them. The true human existence, therefore, only begins when the intellectual mentality emerges out of the material, and we begin more and more to love, to live in the mind, independent of the nervous and physical obsession. And in the measure of that liberty, we're able to accept rightly and rightly to use the life of the body. For freedom, and not a skillful subjection, is the true means of mastery. A free, not a compulsory acceptance of the conditions, the enlarged and sublimated conditions of our physical being. That is the high human ideal. But beyond this, intellectual mentality is the divine. We will pause at this point for today and, God willing, continue next week with another episode from Sri Aurobindo's Synthesis of Yoga. May light pierce all darkness. Marlanka signing off for now.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the City of Dawn.